So, welcome to episode 12, I think we are now. Nice. Which is kind of crazy for us because we started this by accident, genuinely. Okay. So, the fact that 12 people have agreed to come here is mental. But, yeah, so welcome, Andy and Matt. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having
us. I'm really excited for this one because, I don't know, I feel like there's lots of connectedness between why the podcast exists and also why you exist. Mm-hmm. So, that's awesome in itself. But, yeah, thanks for coming on. As we always start, we're going to start with our strange 60 seconds, which sometimes people don't do very well, but I assume you'll do well.
let's start. Let's see.
Favorite restaurant?
Ooh. You go, because you're a foodie. Go
on. Newting's Bar and Grill, Brixton.
Go on.
Great. Okay. Most frustrating app?
For a long time, the ITV app, because you just get stuck in adverts.
Although it's changed now. Have you seen it? It's different.
ITVX, yeah.
Dixon Baxley, I think, did that one.
I actually worked on it, but we went
to
about that.
Yep. Interesting. That's a great one. We'll dig into that a little later. Least favourite colour?
Like mauve.
Be careful.
And I'm trying to think what colours we're not using with clients right now.
probably grey.
Grey, yeah, okay. Yeah. Favourite brand?
Ooh, I love either IKEA or Nintendo.
Okay, two very different brands.
Yeah, they're big on like innovating and play.
Okay. Do you want to go?
Favorite brands, there's a power brand called No Maintenance based in LA that I'm really into at the moment. I think they're doing interesting stuff. It's not a cool brand, but
it doesn't have to be cool.
Come out of left.
Favorite design agency, apart from yourselves?
Can I do like a big shout out?
Go.
Studio Moros.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, love Aries. Big up Aries.
Great. Love a bit of industry love.
Yes. Yeah.
Got to have it. Do I look like a rat or a fish?
Ooh.
Harsh. Fish.
Either way, you're well-dressed.
A well-dressed rat.
Yeah.
Okay.
The beautiful fish out of Shark Tale. Let's go with that.
Do you know what? Most people have said fish. I don't know whether that's a good...
I think you've kind of got that sort of New York... rat vibe.
Fish. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'll take it. Although I've seen them.
New York
I've seen them. And
no,
they're...
rat. New York rat vibe.
Oh my God.
You're the guy.
Started a podcast calling
the host a rat.
Do you know what? Like, I've seen those rats and they are terrifying.
Oh, mate.
They are absolutely terrifying. They're like nothing I've ever seen. City that everyone should know about that's not London.
Stockholm. I love it.
Yeah.
It's such a lovely blend of kind of going out into the world meets sort of Soho vibes.
I'm going to go with Chicago.
Okay.
I had a great time in Chicago. I mean, America's not actually my place.
Yeah.
But Chicago was great. I think there's something about the people there, something about the culture. It's got its issues, but I think it's worth exploring.
I would agree with that. And then at the same time, both of your careers in a noise. 3, 2, 1.
Oi!
Okay.
We're open mouth sounds for some reason.
We've started. We've got there. It was way longer than 60
okay,
seconds.
Yeah, sorry.
It was hard to get.
There's two of us.
We broke the brief already.
Yeah,
sorry.
You've got to give us some.
Okay, let's get into it.
Exactly. So we've started in a weird way. Hopefully, it continues in a weird way because that's more interesting to me.
Okay, cool.
I want to find out more about you guys. I think that's why we're here. But we'll just start independently because I think this is an interesting way to sort of understand more about you. Who was the first person to make you feel talented?
Ooh, good question. Is it first person who made me realize I was talented or first person who kind of like affirmed that in me?
I think like affirmed it maybe.
Probably my like, I think it's my year 9 English language teacher gave me an A for a poem that I wrote.
Okay.
And I was like, that's my first A. Oh, I'm good at something.
And was that unexpected? Did they sort of follow up and reinforce that behavior?
Yeah, it was completely unexpected. Like, because English wasn't the first language spoken at home. My parents are Iraqi and they were refugees. So to be recognized for using a language that, you know, is almost new to me. And then also to be like, I guess, praise for my creativity and how I wrote.
Mm.
I think that had a significant impact on me realizing actually I've got something here. Mm.
Do you think that you saw it as creativity at that time or you were just like, I've done something which is good?
No, I think because I I guess the medium of the poem is that it's supposed to be descriptive. There's beautiful images that are being conjured up in your mind. So, and I spent a long time trying to craft it. So I felt proud of it, but also it was refreshing to have someone else recognize that in me.
Yeah. Mm. Awesome.
Yeah, I think for me, my earliest memory is my granddad picking me up from like nursery. And I guess looking back, it's kind of an intimate time. He's not alive anymore, so I guess I have different attachment to some of the sentiments behind those moments that we shared together. But so my parents would work, he'd pick me up from nursery, we'd walk to his house, which was about like a 15-20 minute walk. And he was always really intentional about affirming things that he thought were good in me. And he had loads of grandkids, so I think the fact that he was spending that intentional time like several times a week being like, I'm interested in your day, what you did was good, I've seen these things that you're doing, these are really good. And he was always someone that regardless like of what everyone else was pursuing, was quite adamant that we all were unique, we all had individual gifts, so I shouldn't chase after what everyone else is doing, but just like stay true to yourself, stay true to your convictions. And so I remember even like being like 4 or 5 years old and him saying like this kind of big, it's always stuck with me, like literally word for word. And he was someone that always said, you're really creative, like pursue creativity, pursue being inspired, pursue inspiring other people. Like that was part of like the mantra that he would speak over me. So that's probably the biggest, earliest influence.
Yeah. And was he creative himself in...
Yeah, so he was Jamaican. Windrush era came over and on the ship, and so I think he was always very handy, very creative, being able to fix problems. And I think his kind of career path was like literally fixing air conditioning units in supermarkets throughout London. But at the same time, he was like a carpenter, so he could like make anything out of wood. It was like, there's something that someone needs, they would go to him and he'd just be like, I can make that, no problem. Yeah. So, you know, the garage didn't have a car in it because they couldn't afford a car. But it was like a workshop filled with stuff. And so like, I would spend like hours in there picking things up and he'd show me how to use tools. And
I guess he was
really creative.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because like our definition of creativity is quite connected to like an industry. Yeah. Whereas like a carpenter is like exceptionally creative in what they do, because you're problem solving and coming to a solution which actually wasn't there at the start, which I think is the definition of being creative, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In a different way. Okay, so I'm intrigued about what you're up to right now. I mean, we can touch into where you sort of came from and kind of how you reached this point, but I think I'm intrigued to find out about Odigy and kind of where that came from, because I think that's the right now. So do you want to take a bit of time explaining what you're up to and what Odigy is?
Yeah, sure. Shall I jump in with
it? Yeah, go on then.
So Odigy today, we call ourselves a culture-aware creative studio for branding and campaigns. When we started it, it definitely wasn't the outfit that we have today. Yeah. I think... there were several reasons why I think the four of us that lead it banded together. So there's myself and Andy. There's also Jared and Steph, who are not here today. That sounded like they're not
alive. not that way.
They're very much alive. they're busy working on a whole bunch of stuff at the moment. And it really started with some shared frustrations, which I think we all felt coming from like a freelancer relationship with the creative industry. So some of us were working in-house at agencies. Some of us were doing the whole freelance kind of creative director, building teams, working on campaigns, being a kind of point person for a whole bunch of creative solutions. And Jared was working as Steph, his wife's agent. So she's a photographer.
Okay.
But also very strategic from a like art school of art background as well, and so just like a multifaceted creative. And we'd worked with each other on a bunch of different things before. And myself and Jared had worked closely for a few years. So I was sat with some friends who were developing a product. I'm getting the full backstory. but they were developing a product which provides mobile energy across certain parts of Africa.
Okay.
Hugely innovative, incredible project. And they said, hey, can we just pick your brains for like an hour? So we sat down, ended up being like 3 hours. And they were like, why don't you just do this full time? Like, what's stopping you banding together with your friends and actually like taking a bigger piece of the pie? Obviously you have a whole bunch of convictions about things that are wrong in the industry or where you're at in a disadvantage because of who you are, you know, how you're perceived in the industry. And I couldn't answer the question like with a no. So I was like, other than the risk and the fear of like setting something up and it's like, wow, this is gonna be hard work. So the next day I got together with my friend Jared for coffee. I shared that conversation that we had and he was like, me and Steph are in. I was like, oh. He's like, yeah, we're facing like a whole glass ceiling for what we have access to, specifically with photography and creative and campaigns. You don't really get any say in the kind of governance scale or decision making within that. And so we feel like if we set something up that looked like that, looked like some kind of agency, then we'd be able to do that. Sat with Andy like literally a couple of days after that. I was like, I'm thinking about doing this thing. And you were in a really exciting, I would say, position at the time with some trajectory with where you were going freelance, working with agencies and gaining a whole bunch of experience. And so Andy probably did the bravest thing. I was like, not yet.
I said, yes, not yet.
And so I was like, okay, my mission then is to try and give you as much work over the next year as possible to kind of give that confidence that it's worth being a part of something, like
to hold
doing
you
this
here.
Together.
You're stuck here now.
You're stuck with us, basically. Yeah. If we can pay you more than anyone else, then great. but I think bigger than that, like we all had shared values. We all have a bunch of experiences which we felt if we just got together and did this, then it could be something really exciting for the industry.
Sure.
And that's not even talking about expertise and experience. And so basically it's been like almost a 4.5 year, 5 year journey of really working on the business, really building what Odigy actually is, learning from the clients that we've worked with the real value that we add and being able to offer that as a viable product that has a return on their investment. And so that's kind of been how we've been doing this. There's a whole like philosophical arm to it as well. I think we're very aware of, well, I was very aware because my phone was ringing all the time from younger talent or people in the industry who were asking me for advice, simple advice, things to do with contracts, things to do with the clients asking for this, I don't know how to respond, to bigger stuff like building teams, production, branding solutions, networking, a whole bunch of things coming from all angles. And I thought, actually, we need to, if I could somehow commodify this and bring the right people together, then we can make this something really exciting. So that was kind of the catalyst behind all of it. And since we all got together, obviously everyone brought their own experience and we challenged ideas, we challenged the way we think we work, and we've finally, I feel like, built something which is really robust and exciting and I think valuable for industry, for future talent, for all that kind of stuff. That's very brave of me probably to say. I probably should say it on a podcast, but we think it's valuable. And I wish that I had access to something like what we are a long time ago.
Sure. And Andy, I'm curious to find out why your definition of why Odigy exists.
Yeah, I think the big thing is representation in positions of influence.
Okay.
So I had my own frustrations kind of coming through the branding agency world and constantly finding myself up against a wall where it felt like there was no one who quite understood where I'd come from, the experiences I had trying to make myself visible in the industry. I probably had to work two or three times harder than most people who were on my team just because of my background, just because of how my parents came to the UK, because of the struggles of growing up in poverty, access to certain parts of education, the language barrier, like you name it. There were several points in my experience that felt like I was always on the back foot. And one of the big things that were kind of sort of settled on my heart when I came out of university was I really want to make sure that at some point in my career, I can pass this on to someone else. Like I can make it easier for the next person. And so even before me and Matt met, I'd always had this dream of setting up a studio where I could create access for future talent. And it always stuck with me what one of my university lecturers said was that junior talent in the industry are the fresh meat. They're the ones who bring the life to the room. They're the ones who come with the left field suggestions, with innovation, with ideas that no one else has thought of. And I think through my experience of being in the industry, I didn't feel like fresh meat. I felt like a side plate.
Yeah.
To use the analogy. So the real heart for me was to be able to go, who needs to be in those positions of influence to make it accessible for the next generation? And how powerful is it for, you know, myself as a British Iraqi man to be a representation for the next Arab, Asian, whatever you name it, person, to see someone there and go, oh, I believe I can do that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think that there's two sides of it. It's like, you need to see it to believe it, don't you? As someone coming out of wherever you're coming, it could be school, it could be, you know, working in a completely different job. Unless you see someone who looks, sounds, thinks like you, it doesn't seem real that you could ever reach that point, you know? And I think that, you know, seeing someone in a position that you could get to is really important. But on the flip side of that, it needs to be accessible for not just one person to move into that agency. It needs to be accessible for a variety of people from a more diverse or, you know, different background who think differently. Because, you know, as you're saying, we're talking about grassroots, you know, people coming from the very start of their career. We have to populate the industry with different people and different thinkers. If not, the same work gets created, you know, you're pitching to the same boards of people, and it all just, the system just keeps going and going and going. Nothing changes. So sort of on that topic, tokenism is something that is spoken about often, and I think that we're in a really unique place where hopefully people are calling it out and noticing it more. Mm-hmm. But like, how do you think tokenism exists in the industry right now?
Oh, that is a great question.
You're trying to get us in trouble.
I mean, there's several layers. From my experience and from what I encounter in conversations with all kinds of people, clients, potential clients, like people that are just doing things in industry or working with products or whatever, like, I think there's the whole, you know, D&I inclusion officer angle, which is, you know, heavily employed by a lot of corporate bodies, government, whatever, organizations, where you see it on LinkedIn, where they basically have acknowledged there's an issue with diversity or representation or a pipeline or whatever makes sense in terms of the bottom line for them. And so they employ a D&I officer, and often that person is just left to somehow protect the business or protect the image. Yeah. So there's a lot of that that's going on. I think there's a lot of gesturing, obviously, that happens. But I think when it comes to tokenism, the thing that I'm encountering is a real lack of engagement with, there's a cost to broadening your awareness of people that are not you, people just that are other. And so I always have this analogy, and I've actually said it to clients before, where I was saying, if you have a barbecue and you just invited your friends, who would come and would they all just look like you? And it's a really challenging question, because then it's more of a personal cost. Like, am I willing to engage with people that just don't look like me, aren't at the same pay scale as me? And I have this conversation all the time. It's so funny. I have a conversation even in the playground. I've got a daughter, she's 5 years old, in the playground with people that work in tech, people that work in finance. And often they really want me and like my daughter to be there. She's mixed race, because it feels to them like, oh, there's a bit of vibrancy. I've done my bit. And so I think it exists at all levels, like with our bias. And I think, I don't know, I've been fortunate enough to be raised in an environment and a community where I have Filipino friends, Indian friends, I have people all from the whole, not just one African friend, but Nigerians, Ghanaians, people from Sierra Leone, people from Kenya. Like, so I think it feels very natural when you are the other, where you tick the passport box, which is like Black British other. When you tick that box, you're automatically assimilated with other. And I think you find synergy with those people throughout industry and creativity, which is why, you know, we look at the people we work with, they're so diverse. And it's not just race, it's gender, ethnicity, heritage, all kinds of diversity. And so I think when we talk about tokenism, I'm yet to find a significant number of people who are attributing the cost to really do that well, which then says to me that a lot of what is being done is in some element tokenistic and will probably not add much value for the foreseeable future, really.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that there's all sorts of, there's loads of work that needs to be done to enable, you know, tokenism to not feel like, you know, tokenism to not be so apparent, because it is, you know, within advertising and design and product design, it's very, very clear because of the access to actually that route to get to that point, you know, this the but I think that it's not just getting someone in a business, it's actually retaining that person to feel like that business is home.
Yeah.
Because I previously worked at a company where the primary responsibility of us was to increase, you know, diversity, inclusion. That was why we were brought on.
Okay.
And in reality, that sounds amazing. And I was very excited to be in businesses and doing this. But nothing changed actually when you got when you were in these agencies. You know, it was a line above the door to get you in there, but then actually it didn't really. Yeah. There was no commitment to actually making a change. It was too much. It was too far. The effort was too much.
Yeah.
So actually, like, it's interesting to hear you say that. You know, more needs to be done, and maybe not enough is done, because even simple things like, I was speaking to a guy. He was Muslim. And he was having real problems in the agency, because the only way that he could actually network socially was in a pub.
Yeah.
And that's such a massive culture within advertising and creative, you know, to go to the pubs, talk about stuff, to burn away your frustrations. Yeah. But he's like, what business do I have going into a pub? Yeah. You know, that's not my place.
Yeah.
And like, it's, you don't think about this stuff, it, like, if that's your life and that's what you've existed in. But for him, that was like, I just don't go, because I'd rather not, that's not my place. So how do we need to listen to people. I think that's the biggest part, is actually listening to who people are, and understanding who people are, to not suggest to someone to go somewhere which actually isn't their place, you know, because it doesn't make them feel at home.
Yeah, I describe it to some friends as like heretical structures, where you could be saying all the right things, you could be posting all the right things, you could be promoting all the right things, you could even believe all the right things, but behind the scenes, nothing's actually changing. Like, structurally, you're still making the same mistakes.
Yeah.
And in order to be able to change those things, you need someone to kind of give you a sober moment of going, you need to recognize you're not doing it.
Yeah.
And the only way you're going to do that is by inviting those voices in.
Of course.
It has to start from the top. Unfortunately, you know, you could hire as many diverse people into your team, but if the person at the top is not listening or acknowledging those changes, then nothing's going to change.
Yeah, 100%. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, the person at the top actually has no connection with.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so disconnected, as it's very clear. I think, you know, this could be a hard question for you to answer, but I appreciate, but what is the one thing that agencies can do to enable access to a more diverse group of humans?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of answers, because I'm fully aware that, we're diverse in makeup, so we don't want to be coming across as the experts in this. Because we're still figuring out. We're learning it just as much.
Yeah,
we feel like the newbies as well in this. So, I think there's a lot we can do, and we can learn from a lot of people, and probably the answers are found in our teams. We just need to give a space for those people to bring up suggestions. I mean, for myself, a big deal is access, like from grassroots, like don't start at, university level, go back to secondary school, go back to primary school, understand where parents are at, like understand how children are growing up and like what opportunities they have and they don't have. So invest at the lower level in terms of education, I would say. I don't know if you had any suggestions as well.
Yeah, I think we've spoken a little bit about cost, right? And what people are willing to really, are they really willing to put the money where their mouth is? I think there's a lot of assumptions around what things should cost without actually acknowledging, hey, let's look at this as experimental territory. We don't know what it's going to cost, but we understand there's value there. So we're willing to do whatever it takes to see something that we can genuinely say is valuable to our own context, whatever the agency looks like. So I think that's one thing, is being able to not budget yourself into like a return, but actually just pursue change. Like, what is that? Are we willing to really go after this? I think the other thing though to acknowledge is like a lot of, from again, conversations that we have with talent, a lot of people are quite tired of being the advocate because they are the only other.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that we do need to acknowledge is, do we empower people to speak up and be able to critique the experience that they're having to be the most productive, do their most effective work? I know you gave the example about the pub. There's so many examples about, like, there's only one microwave and people microwave pork and stuff in therefore you can't. So there's so many, and it's not just about the little things in an environment, but it's actually like the methodology in practice, like where are voices allowed access, where are opinions and perspectives are being able to be drawn from. I think these are all things we need to, especially now we're speaking to a global audience. There's more at stake now more than ever for the perception of a brand or a product. And I think there's vibrancy in life when people are really empowered to present the other thing,
the thing that
is untested, unknown, we don't fully get it. But okay, rather than you just advocating and fighting to have a voice, what if we like liberated you to be creative and bring something into this in a really new way, whether just it's for the business, whether it's for a project, whether it's for, you know, anything. I think it's a great time to experiment, and I think that is really empowering for people to see, hey, I'm actually able to contribute. I think there's obviously more meta stuff when we talk about education and access and things like that. I'm not sure how far agencies can really do that, but I'd like to see really, you know, the big players in the game take real big initiative in the future. Not just award bodies or, you know, actually like real businesses do that. So
I think as well, like there's lots of little decisions that can be made, but there can also be some big radical ones as well. And with those radical decisions come a cost on those who are actually in charge and power. And it's asking yourself the question, am I willing to take that cost in order to benefit someone else? There's a lot of you know, our industry promotes progression and it rewards people based off that. But I don't think there's much room, well, this is my observation, I'm generalizing here, but there's not a lot of room for compassion to helping pull people up as well at the same time. So, you know, I would challenge, like, if you were a studio and, you know, 95% of your senior leadership are white and they're male, and you have middleweights who are from diverse backgrounds, are you willing to step down or step aside and allow them to come into that role and find their way in it and give them space to do that? Otherwise, what we end up doing is we get this elite class of seniors who, when they hit a glass roof, they go to the next company. And you just cycle these people through all the different studios. Whereas all the diverse talent are basically hitting this glass roof and going, there's no way I can go up, because as soon as that position opens up, someone else comes and fills it. So we need to be considerate of, like, this idea of, like, competency and confidence and, like, what validates someone to be in that position of power. And can we recognize potential in people and go, let's give you some space so that you can grow into that role, so that actually the very physical makeup of our studio changes.
I think that, because the reason Unknown exists is to go further and look further than other people are looking, and we take a lot of responsibility to do that. But what I always fall back on and makes me feel kind of sorry for is that we have to go further to find people. You know, we have to really work, and a lot of our, you know, most of our days is trying to find parts of the industry that aren't so, you know, people aren't doing those rounds of same agencies, you know. So there's that, but often a pushback, and I begin to hear your thoughts on this, is you can't hire what doesn't exist. And like, even that sentence is quite difficult to like think about, because, you know, yes, we need to, we all know, I mean, you're stupid if you don't understand that the grassroots is where we're going to make a big change in the industry. But to think that, you know, you can't hire what doesn't exist at a senior level, there's that, that's the biggest sentence to show there's a real problem with, you know, access to, you know. So how does that make you feel, that sentence?
Yeah, it's a challenging one, right? I think, I don't know why I was reminded of this story, but someone, there's a friend of ours who advises us on occasion. I won't say the name, but based in Hollywood, works for big visual effects company, and they work on Star Wars specifically. And they had a brief for an explosion, basically, in one of their recent Star Wars films. And the brief for the explosion was an explosion like we've never seen before.
Okay, good brief.
So how do you approach that? In the same way that if we're saying it doesn't exist, well, for me, then that's a challenge to figure out the answer. Like, why does something not exist? In the same way that we do when we look at space and the stars, we try and figure out, why does it not exist? Is it a problem?
We look at a creative brief.
Or yeah, how do we manifest something we've never seen before? Yeah. Like that we're struggling to understand. And so this individual basically went through YouTube and found, like, I think it was like the Slow Mo Brothers or whatever that did like underwater explosion.
Yeah.
And he was like, I've never seen anything. I didn't even know how they came to think that this is something to do.
Yeah.
And they used that as a base to bring into the movie, and they replicated something quite similar. But what's interesting about that is it's created a spark for other things where they thought, not just what are our blind spots, because we all do that in business. What are our blind spots? Because it's essentially not making us money and we need to fix it. But actually, like, what are the things that we haven't spent time thinking, what don't we see? Like, what are we not even looking at? And so that made them think about, when we choose a director for a movie, are we just going to the same director because they've proven themselves and it's no risk? When we choose a DOP, when we choose branding design for in movies, like, are we just going to the same people because we've worked with them for 20 years?
Yeah.
What are we not seeing? What's exciting? What's out there? And so it's interesting. I know it's a long stretch, I feel like, from the original question. But I think when we're saying, like, it's not out there, our challenge, are we looking in the right places? How are we actually spending time to challenge ourselves to think in a new way, to consider options that don't exist? Do we, you know, rather than just going to the same design schools or graduate fairs or graduate events, are we thinking about the young individual who, with Microsoft XP, is working in a flat in Bermondsey, single parent home, but has spent hours in front of a computer screen and is exceptionally talented? Yeah. And is that talent transferable for the skills that we're actually looking for? Have we thought, I know that's a long stretch of a visual, but I'm just trying to paint the image there, is that I feel like there's answers everywhere if we're willing to look. I think when you start to speak to people who are others, you find that their way of thinking is different, and that actually that way of thinking could be so valuable.
Yeah, absolutely.
For all kinds of solutions. So I think when we're saying, like, hiring talent, I think, are we willing to take the risk on something that doesn't fit the credentials we're used to?
Yeah.
Of
course.
I think if there's more of that being asked, then I would argue that that question becomes increasingly more redundant.
Yeah. I would even say, like, our industry is built off creativity. Creativity allows room for exploration, for expression, for trying new things. So if we're in an industry where we go and we can't fill that space, it kind of defies what we're all about. So we need to be putting in that extra work to go, how do we problem solve this in a creative way? Like, where should we be looking elsewhere to find, you know, the preferred person in that position, or someone who could bring something new to it? So we're not always relying on maybe sort of like an archaic model of how things should be structured. I mean, when you asked that question, I was like, I'm that person. Like, everyone looked at me and was like, no, not Andy. He's good at those things, but he's not good at that. And I was just like, well, you've not recognized those things already in me. Yeah. Like, you need to pull them out. So, like, I've had the frustration of having to, like, prove myself over and over and over again to the point where I was like, okay, now I'm in a position where people are listening, and it's taken twice as long, three times as long, because someone else wasn't able to recognize that. But then there have been people who have brought me on team and gone, there's potential in that guy. I don't know how it's going to look when it comes out the other side, but there's something exciting there. So then they were able to kind of impart their wisdom and their skill set back to me. So there's a level of mentorship that needs to be put in place, and you need to give space for that in order for people to grow into those, because it's not just like you can buy someone off the shelf and put them there. If it's missing, you need to go and find someone who can fill that space and help them to get there.
Yeah, I think it's another reason, I think, why we're seeing lots of younger creatives starting their own thing, because they're like, there's no one there for me, you know, so I'm going to make this myself. But they shouldn't have to feel like that at the start of their career, you know, which is like lots of other people, you know, who've come from the same schools and been to the same universities and done all that sort of stuff, never feel that feeling, you know? So I think there's this strange combination of people. But yeah, I think it's like we're at a really interesting point. Like, obviously, spending some time in New York, there's obviously lots of cultural issues with the US as an entire place. But I think that
was put very gently.
I know. Yeah, I like, you did well. But New York, I think, is a really unique place. It's like a different country. And I think that one thing that I definitely felt was that they've taken diversity much more seriously for longer than we have in London, because I guess it is a very much metropolitan city, and I think lots of people have come from lots of different areas and places, so they're sort of, you're bunched into a really small place. But I think what is really nice is seeing that, you know, when you visit agencies, it feels like a much more diverse place.
Reflection of the city.
It feels like you're in New York when you're in an agency, whereas I think in some places in London, it doesn't. Well, you feel like you're in London. You feel like you're in a creative place in London, which is very white and male, essentially. Yeah. So, yeah, interesting. I guess, sort of speaking more about, because we've spoken a lot about sort of diversity, and I know that's very, you know, you guys are very passionate about that, but the work, I'm really keen to talk about the work, like, because part, again, linking it a bit back to Unknown, part of why we exist is we're very talent driven, and actually we want to represent truly inspirational and unique creatives who are doing the best work. I think the work is always like a really big part of why people are hiring people. But like, what would you say Odigy's special sauce is? Why do clients come to you?
I think there's several things that our special source. One is that there's not actually like agencies I find that look like us. I think if I speak on what our clients reflect back to us, is they're always so encouraged to work with us because just in our DNA, we look different. The way we talk is a bit unorthodox. The way they operate is probably quite different from a lot of agencies from our experience being in the industry. So it's something refreshing. It's something that brings kind of a new insight into things. And so we always work well with clients that are looking for that and have that ambition. With any kind of project that they bring us into. But I think when we talk about ourselves being this cultural aware creative agency, it's not saying that we've got like, we're the culture kids, we know everything, we're like super woke and have all this stuff. It's not that. I think there's things within our methodology, the way that we do our work, the way that we produce, that draws on genuine cultural insight, draws from people. It's all really centered around people. And within culture, there's so much fabric in that. There's everything from language to expression, so arts to competitiveness, like sports, entertainment. There's all this stuff within the fabric, but heritage, tradition, and that's all stuff that's really important for building brands that have an essence of integrity within them. And so for clients that are looking to speak to global audiences, for clients that are interested in working in new innovative ways that just think even more holistically than sometimes we may consider, that's kind of where we add something a bit unique, a bit bespoke, a little bit different. And because we're small, it means that we don't need to get carried away with, you know, the big ways of working, but we're very humble. We're very naive intentionally in some ways, because it allows us to ask questions, allows us to stay curious, allows us to, you know, find real solutions that we can actually, that we believe are actually worth employing us for. So I think that's what's unique. And that only comes from what we know about the journey that, especially the four of us that set it up, what we've been through. That, again, like, we're trying to set something up that I would love my daughter to be involved in one day if she decided this was a career path for her.
Yeah.
There's some model which she can see herself being a part of and understand how she can contribute value, not just to working in a place, but to like to clients. That's like such a, it's almost like a magical thing. Like, I had an idea and it really brought something of worth to someone where they couldn't find that solution, that idea. I think that's like a really incredible thing. So I think that's what we would say is special about us from our experience.
I'd even say, just to add to that in terms of the more creative side of things, I would say we're not afraid to do the wrong thing. And I'll unpack that a little bit just in case clients start getting worried. I think it's just our attitude for going, okay, what's the predictable thing to happen in this scenario? Like, if you were to approach any other agency, how would they approach this? And then to say, well, let's look for alternate solutions. By makeup, we're different and we see things differently and we add different perspectives to the table. welcomed everyone's thoughts and ideas. Okay, let's entertain the thought of doing something that is left field, that is unexpected, and can that be fresh and rejuvenate the creativity in the room? Can it surprise our clients and make them see things beyond what they would expect to see from any other agency? So I think there's power in having those different perspectives in the room, because you do bring the fresh meat, you do bring something new to the table, and we love to ask the question, what would be the wrong thing to do in this scenario?
Yeah.
What would be the wrong answer? Because that might actually be the right answer.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. We do exactly the same. I'm always asking, like, what don't you want to see? Like, yeah. What don't you want us to do? Who don't you want us to find? And then ultimately what we're trying to unpack is getting further away from what they think they want to see.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. When you're asking them, where don't you want to, you know, hire someone from? Sometimes you can challenge that. Well, actually, why don't you want that person? And if there's a justification as to why, a good one, then I'll take that. But if it's like, well, you know, they don't do the same work as us, it's like, that's what you need then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's not a novelty thing. It's not going like, let's just come up with a silly idea and hopefully it does something. It's going, we've really understood the client. We've really taken time to consider where they've come from, what their beliefs are, what their values are. And then we've gone, what's a new way of approaching this? Mm. And then how can we present it to the client in a way that they're surprised and go, wow, this is amazing. I would never have thought of doing something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even one of our junior talent, Bents, he's popping off, excuse the pun, but he's like, he's doing balloon fashion.
Okay.
So he makes items of fashion, like bags, dresses,
I mean, before we even get there, I feel like shout out to Bents, because he's just someone that exceeds expectation all the time. We brought in this guy. He had a similar kind of, school of design background as I did, studied architecture, realized that wasn't something he wanted to do, but picked up a whole set of skills that were valuable for being generally creative.
Yeah.
Really interested in content creation, 3D, all kinds of stuff. So he's just this like multidisciplinary creative. And we brought him in because we were just like, he's a great energy in the room. He's really talented. Like, we'll figure out where he adds value like along the way, but he can do loads of stuff. And then we just kept discovering stuff. Then we'd just be like, Bents, like, how do you know how to do that? Or we'd see a picture of him with like this crazy balloon sculpture. And he was like, oh yeah, I was like a junior balloon sculpting champion when I was 14. And we were like, wait, what? So anyway.
So yeah, he's basically like infiltrating the fashion industry now with balloons.
Via balloons.
Like he's gone viral on TikTok.
Yeah, he's made like handbags for like, or like Moncler and start like,
that's
and he's
sick.
been in music videos creating like sculptures. Like
in the space of a week, his dress was in Times Square on a big screen.
That's so cool.
And it was just like, and he was like, oh yeah, I just made this like corset and I walked through Selfridges and someone noticed it and was like, can you be in our music video?
Yeah.
So it's that type of person where you're going, he's the wrong person to be in this studio, but he's completely the right person to be in this studio
because
he adds so much value to our process.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I'm curious of time.
Yes.
But I'm keen to talk about kind of what's happening in the world right now. There's one big thing that's happening in the world right now, which is the World Cup.
Yeah, big time.
And there's all sorts of interesting points of topic around that. To kind of keep it plugged into, you know, you guys and kind of what you're doing, do you think that Qatar regret having the World Cup in Qatar?
This is where we get cancelled.
I mean,
we've spoken about this already a little bit.
Yeah, we've had conversations because we felt conflicted because we both love football. And I think, you know, there's a big ethics question. But then whenever there's an ethics question presented, you start to compare it to like, okay, what's the other big world issue? Like, does it trump that? Is it better? Like, literally Trump.
Great segue.
Trump, yeah, should get into that one as well. And so, yeah, you're trying to be like, well, who's justified to host any world sporting event? Didn't we just have the athletics championship like next door?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So anyway, it starts to get into like the compare and blame game. But I think, you know, the question is, do they regret it? I don't think they do. I mean, I was reading some like business executive guy in HuffPost and he was like, we're happy the world stage is here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because now there's conversations on a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think like, you know, auntie and uncle who are just chilling in Qatar doing their own thing, we can't just label everyone in that nation as the, yeah. I mean, we've got thoughts on how that's even affected, like, I guess part of your heritage.
Oh,
like,
man, anytime I mention that my parents are from Iraq, I'm sure even as I said it to you, something came to mind. And like, that's been a problem that's, you know, I've had to carry around. Mm. And it's not my issue in that sense. So I think we've got to be careful when we say Qatar, because we're labeling the entire nation.
Absolutely.
What we're really talking about is the organization that agreed to do that with FIFA.
Absolutely.
So, you know, leave auntie and uncle alone. They're just looking after their family.
Yeah.
So there's going to be lots of Qataris out there who are going, you probably resonate with this, to go, it's not our fault. There'll be some out there who'll be like, we actually agree with you. We're equally frustrated by all of this. So we just got to be careful about that in the first instance.
And I guess they've got to live it, you know? I mean,
yeah.
And it would be so strange, I think, someone who's culturally always grown up in Qatar and seeing there's millions of people that have never, you know, that are completely different, culturally different. It's like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
You know, this is suddenly, it's a fascinating time. I think because it's on such a world stage, and because culturally it feels so different to what a lot of us are used to, and the regulations and the restrictions that have been put on people, you forget that, you know, we're very different. You know, the two places are very different. We're talking about, you know, us growing up and living in or being in London. It's just a different world, isn't it? And I think that maybe it is good that there's exposure of us having understanding of what's different out there.
Yeah.
You know, just because we view something as wrong or bad doesn't mean it necessarily is. I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing to say, but...
I think as long as there's a genuine pursuit of justice, then I think that's a good thing. Like, I think what has happened is like a travesty, like people losing their lives for the sake of building like an entertainment infrastructure sounds like something from like the Roman times. But I think that at the same time, it's that there's a lot of people who are going to be galvanized to seek justice and to somehow create a meaningful contribution to enact that justice. So I don't think a young guy who's grown up with football as his entire life can even think about how kicking the ball can translate to that. I think we have to have a bit of, I guess, compassion for across the whole board, and how do we, how does our humanity find a solution to all of this?
So. Yeah. Yeah, because I think we're asking a lot for players to, you know, I'm on the fence with this.
So are we?
Because it's like, I think if I truly inherently believe something, you know, if my brother, sister, auntie, uncle was gay and I was playing for the team, I'd be like, I don't think I'd be able to not, inside myself, not be very outlandish in my opinion on something.
Right.
But then would I? Because I'm in part of a team, and do I want to be the guy who's making the scene when what we're here to do is try and win the World Cup? So it's like, it's hard. I think it is really challenging. Do you think that any brands, because if we again bring it back to, it feels weird to bring this back to like brands and, you know, campaign work, and because there's deeper rooted issues with all of this than someone trying to sell some cereal or something, for example.
Cereal at the World Cup.
I don't know. Maybe people, they can't drink beer, so maybe they want some cereal.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Frosties do a bit of a football thing at one point?
I mean, surely they must have.
Surely this was like Bovril's opportunity to shine.
Why Bovril?
Because, you know, people, if you never had Bovril at a football game? You never been.
He's
been
from up north, so
yeah, you've been to the north. You need to go watch a game at like Sunderland or whatever.
Definitely had Bovril at a football game before. Yeah.
Get some Bovril. They should have been like, no beer. It's time for Bovril. Why did we not pitch that?
Matt, you needed to be in the room.
I needed to be in the room.
But apart from Bovril standing out,
with
in our imagination,
yeah,
are there any brands who've been severely positive and come out of the World Cup in a good way with the work they've done, or vice versa? Is there anyone who's completely flopped it and done a...
I think it's worth acknowledging, because of so much noise around the World Cup, I think it's going to drown out any brand attempt, whether it's good or bad. Like, you won't fully appreciate it for what it is, because as people's attention are being diverted elsewhere. But I think, yeah, I think for the ones that have done well, it's almost like invisible to me. It's almost like, oh, it's just another advert.
Yeah, of course.
And for the ones that have done bad, they get dragged into the big political, social, ideological conversation, and then it's like, yikes, you're in trouble. So
yeah, and I think especially when things are so raw, you know, when it's affecting so many people, you can get it really wrong.
Yeah,
and it almost goes further than it was ever meant to. You know, no one's intending to offend unless you're creating some kind of like guerrilla campaign.
Yeah,
like no one's intending to offend at that point, but actually then people get it really, really wrong.
Which is
interesting. Okay, well, we'll try and do this last section quick fire because we've only got a couple of minutes. But we call this section Elephant Vomit. I said this in the last podcast. I don't really know why it's called that. I think it was meant to be like
vomited.
Well, yeah, I think it was meant to be like elephant in the room. Kind of something that you want to address, but I don't know how vomit came into it. But anyway, let's stop using that word because maybe if you both already have spoken about something you dislike within the world or something that you hate within the industry, maybe you've already had that conversation. But quick fire, something you don't think should exist in the world. I'm going to say mine just you get some context.
Go.
I don't like world all-you-can-eat buffets.
Yeah.
I think they shouldn't exist.
Yeah, fair.
I don't think they have a place for us as humans.
A lot of waste of food.
And also very like mediocre. Like everything's kind of equally bad.
Yeah.
At the same level.
Yeah.
Another one that I don't like, which is more controversial, is melon.
Which type of melon?
All melons. Oh, you know, all everyone melons. Always asks that question. It's like,
because I know some people like they hate cantaloupes. But they would love a watermelon.
Specific with the melons.
Yeah, but I know. I don't know different genres of melon.
Is it the flesh, the flavour?
I don't. It just does nothing to me. Honestly, I really don't.
So it's actually the you don't like the taste. You don't like
don't like the taste.
Wow.
But I'm intrigued. This is hard for you to answer because this is.
Yeah.
But is there anything that you don't like / shouldn't exist?
I don't like it when I'm at Sainsbury's and everyone's waiting for the self-checkout, but they won't move down.
Okay.
They all like congest at the top and it's like, there's like 10 more at the end. Can you move? So I just skip the queue and everyone's like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, you're not going. So
I'm
going to do my shopping.
You're one of those
Same
guys.
On the tube, isn't it? It's like everyone congests in the middle and the aisles are empty and you're just like, okay.
Yeah, it's always that's always a really tense part of the tube, isn't it? That by door
such
place.
An intimate place as well. I don't really want to be under your armpit right now.
No, I know. Any others? Any others that you think of? First, last little.
I mean, I don't like the quality control process of McDonald's.
Bro, why are you still going there?
And it's not the quality of the food. It's actually what arrives in my bag. So I don't know if I'm cursed with it or what, but the amount of times I leave and there's just no fries or they just don't put sauces in and I ask them and it's never there.
Yeah.
And I'm really not about that. I know that's a bit of a joke. One thing that I don't think we've cracked also is the whole,
here it comes.
This is such a first world problem. The democratization of purchasing trainers.
Okay.
Oh my goodness, we've been talking about this week.
Just the apps, like, I mean, the Nike one is actually, but there's a lack of transparency. And all I then see is like people on social media with like 30 boxes of the same trainers, like backdoor. Yeah.
Boxes in the back of a van. It's like,
I just think it's all a bit of a lie. The whole thing's a bit of a lie. Yeah. So I think there needs to be some way of being transparent about it. To be honest, someone was telling me about blockchain and actually how it's the solution. And I'm like, it actually does make sense if there's a public ledger of all this stuff. But then I can just hunt down everyone that's been. But I think there's a solution there that makes sense for everyone where we're like, okay, because I agree, people queuing up in tents and all kinds of stuff outside of shops, whatever, for trainers is crazy on so many levels. But anyway, that whole system is and reselling.
But
and
it's designed to feed into this whole like
100%
thing. Yeah. It's like 100%. this isn't by chance. This has been planned to exist in this way. Yeah. It's like the thought of being able to like, you know, it's this is not accidental that this exists. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of big like players in this industry that are making a lot of money.
I would say the same for Pokemon cards. Pokemon card. Look, I'm not joking. Last year, they printed 9 billion cards, and it's based off an idea of gambling. You try and get your booster pack. You try and find the rare ones. Everyone's learning about my interest now. But I am genuinely concerned about what it's teaching children. because they're just spending their pocket money on these useless cards that get chucked in the bin, and if they don't get the rare ones, and it's like
this is true, yeah.
And I'm just like, what are you teaching children in this? Like, obviously, have fun, get the games in like
have fun, kids.
Have fun, kids.
Have fun, kids. Don't do Pokemon cards.
Anyway, we probably need to end now because I mean, we could probably talk for hours. But thank you very much, guys.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
I think that that was really good topics of conversation there. I think a lot of people will find that interesting. So. Thanks very much, and speak to you soon, hopefully.
Thanks for having us.